This past Wednesday, we bid farewell to Vince Speranza, one of my former interviewees, a true American hero and veteran of World War II. Born in 1925, he valiantly served as a paratrooper in the esteemed 101st Airborne Division during the historic Battle of the Bulge. Throughout his life, Vince's unwavering commitment to his country and fellow soldiers earned him the admiration of many. His bravery on the battlefield and his dedication to the memory of fallen comrades have left an indelible mark on the hearts of generations of Americans. Beyond the battlefield, Vince's legacy of service continued as he shared his firsthand accounts at events and commemorations. He shared his firsthand accounts with me. As we remember Vince Speranza, we honor a hero who exemplified the best of America. His courage and sacrifice will forever remain an inspiration, and his memory will live on in the annals of history. Rest in peace, Vince Speranza. Your legacy of bravery and selflessness will never be forgotten. In honor of him, I want to present to you my interview with him from last year, where we discuss him fighting in the Battle of the Bulge, liberating a concentration camp, and a lot more. Wait until you hear his airborne beer story. And now I give you the dearly departed Vince Speranza.
What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? Or seeing Queen at Live Aid? Our past is a collection of stories that bring us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning into this episode of Eyewitness History. This episode, I have the great honor and privilege of speaking with Vince Speranza. Speranza was drafted into the United States Army on October 25th, 1943, and officially entered the service November 15th that same year. He was sent to Camp Upton in New York, where he stayed until he was sent to Fort Benning in Georgia, where he trained for the infantry with the 87th Infantry Division. He volunteered for the parachute infantry and was sent back to Fort Benning for training. He was subsequently sent overseas with Company H, 3rd Battalion, 501st Parachute Infantry Regiment, 101st Airborne Division from Camp Shanks on board the Queen Mary. His unit arrived in France and would later fight in the infamous Battle of the Bulge. Speranza spent 144 days in combat. He received 2 Purple Hearts and 2 Bronze Stars for his service and other medals of distinction. After the war, Vince became a teacher at Curtis High School. Most recently, he recounted the events attached to his years in the military in his book, Nuts, a 101st Airborne Division machine gunner at Bastogne. I am here with Vince Speranza. Vince, thank you so much for coming on the podcast, sir.
You're welcome. Good to meet with you again, Josh.
Yes, sir. My honor. I'm so excited to have you on. I'm excited to discuss certainly your war stories, your book, your life, your message. But before we do, Vince, I wonder if you might do me a favor and tell our listeners just kind of briefly who you are and what you've done, if that's possible.
And within 2 hours or three?
Yeah. Take all the time you need, sir.
Well, folks, my name is Speranza, Vincent J. I was born in New York City. 1925. You don't have to do the math. I'm 97 years old, but I'm still active. I went to school at PS22, Richmond on Staten Island. I was a normal kid, got into the usual mischiefs, but never anything with the law. And I was a fairly good student, but remember in those days during the Depression, at age 12, your childhood is over. The city of New York allows you to apply for working papers for 20 hours a week. And, of course, nobody paid attention to that part of it. But you could work after school for 20 hours a week, providing your grades were being checked up. And so everybody, all the boys, not girls now, all the boys at age 12, there were 4 boys in my family, and 4 girls. My father believed in equal gender deployment. The boys at age 12, your mother dresses you up nicely and combs your hair and takes you by the hand and takes you downtown and stops at all the little shops and stores. Could you use the help of a young boy? He's very smart. Look at his eyes. And invariably, there'll be somebody there that needs a young boy. And the place we stopped at was an importer, Italian importer grocery store. And I stood at attention while my mother described what a good kid I was and how talented I was and all that. And the lady said, okay, does he have a bicycle? And Mom said, yes. We had an old junk that my brother put together from parts, but it was a bicycle. And I was hired on as a delivery boy. Every day from 3 to 6, and Saturday, 7:30 in the morning till 7:30 at night, and Sunday, half a day from 9 to 1, and my pay was $1.25 a week.
Hmm.
Which I proudly plunked on the table at the end of the day. That, and you know, when your father's only making $8 a week, and if you can put $1.50 on the table there, you're doing your yeoman's work to keep the family going. So from age 12 on, all kinds of different jobs right on through to high school. And it was good for you. You know, you didn't have time to go fooling around after school. But you learned what it took to make a dollar. You learned how to spend it wisely when your mother gave you the $1.25, the quarter back. Mm. Take your brother to the movies. And you matured a little earlier, and that wasn't a bad thing. Okay, fast forward to December 7, 1941. I'm 16 years old and in high school. It was a Sunday. And I'm riding my bicycle to a shop that my parents had sent me to. And when I got inside the shop, it was absolutely silent. So I finally said, hey, they said, shut up. President Roosevelt is speaking. He's saying something about the Japanese and Pearl Harbor. You know, first of all, where the hell's Pearl Harbor? But I jumped on my bike and I ran home quick to pedal home to my, I said, Pop, quick, put the radio on. Now, this was a Sunday afternoon, so the whole family is there. And we're all sitting around and listening to the radio. And what comes on is, and a state of war exists between the Empire of Japan and the United States of America. And we will win the ultimate victory, so help us God. My father turned around from the radio. For the first time, we saw tears. My father was a tough man. We saw tears in his eyes. He lined up his four sons. My kid Rocky was only 12. That was 14. I was 16. Joey was 21. Boys, listen. This country must not fail. Understand, boys? This country must not fail. Nowhere in the entire world can a man come with nothing except a willingness to work. And look at us today. Look, we have a home and a car and a vacation. Boys, he said, I expect my sons to. We said, Pop, yeah, but they won't take us till we're 18. Said, I know, but I just want you to know how I feel about it. Understand, boys? He looked every one of us in the eye. It was steel. Okay, Pop, we got it. We got it. And I think those were the defining words for the rest of my life. I hope that everything I have done since that day has helped to make sure this country does not fail. Because it's the most magnificent country ever created by man. And so I had to go back to school for 2 years before we could do and get into the service. And, you know, it looked bad. The Germans had taken all of Europe and they were going to Russia. The Japanese were almost down to Australia and so on. You know, we were anxious to get into the fight. We tried putting our father's fedoras on, a couple of guys from the neighborhood and I. We put our father's fedoras on. We let a little go down here. We went down to the recruiting sergeant and said, where do you want to join the army? Recruiting sergeant says, go home. Come back when you're really 18. We need you, but get out of here. Well, we were embarrassed and ashamed, but we went back and had faced up to waiting 2 years before we could get into the service and do something about the war. Well, the day finally came. I was 18 years old, March 23rd, 1943. The law then was within 2 weeks of your birthday, you get a letter from the greetings from the President of the United States. The letter said, within the next 2 weeks, please report to your nearest draft board and register. We rushed down to the draft board to register. And can I volunteer for the air? They said, hey, you can't even get in yet until we call you. Do you understand? We're still building training camps. We can't handle everybody yet. You wait until we notify you, and then you report to the Army recruiting. Well, I had to wait from March to October before they finally called me.
Wow.
And I charged into the army and said, I want to be in the infantry, the Marines, and something where you get close to the fighting. Sit down and behave yourself until I tell you what to do. So you sit down, and an officer comes out, a sergeant comes out, and takes you in for a series of tests, written exam. And then an officer sits down with you with your test results, and he says, Brandon, you did 97 in mechanical aptitude. You like tanks? And I said, yeah. And you did da-da-da-da in math, and do you like the artillery? I said, yeah. And you did, you know, it gives you a whole bunch of things you qualified for, and then takes a big stamp, infantry, which is what we wanted anyway. You know, your uncles give you all this kind of advice before you go into the service. You know, don't, whatever you do, don't go into the infantry. What was it? Listen, in the infantry, a lot of people get killed. Yeah, but you get killed in all branches of the service. Yeah, but not like the infantry. And you got to live in a whole volunteer for the Navy or the Air Force or anything. Of course, I wanted to be a fighting soldier. And you don't do that flying an airplane or sitting on a ship. At any rate, they sent me to Fort Benning, Georgia, the infantry school. Now, by the way, this is the first time we've been more than 10 miles from home. We were innocent kids right out of high school. And now this new big adventure, you know, going to go way down to Georgia. And we're all anticipating that what it's going to be like when we get down to the camp. There's a big sergeant there. Get off the bus. Line up, you. And he called us some kind of names. But now get this. My name is Sergeant Mastarelli. You got it? We said, yes, sir. He said, don't give me that, sir. Said, you saved that for the officers. I'm Sergeant Mastarelli. You got it? Yes, sir. Now, I got 19 weeks to turn you little students into soldiers. And by God, I'm going to do it. You got it? Yes, Sergeant. All you got to remember is when Mastarelli says jump, you say how high and how far. You got it? Yes, sir. Yes, sir. He scared the hell out of us. Now get into those barracks and come out looking like soldiers. Oh, we ran like hell into the barracks and put on our uniforms and so on and so on. And we loved the training. We gobbled it up. They taught us all about, you know, shooting rifles, the physical training, 30-mile hikes with a full field pack. And hand-to-hand combat. And because we were anxious, we gobbled it up. We all tried to exceed abilities. And at the end of that 19 weeks, we were something else. We weren't the 18-year-old kids anymore that came in from the high school. And we're now ready. Hey, okay, let's go get into that fight. No, you have to come back for 4 more weeks of advanced infantry training. Now, right, we're going into the fight. No. You got to come back for 2 more weeks of heavy weapons training.
Oh, good grief.
Okay. Go back for 2 more weeks of heavy. Now, right? No, first you have to be assigned to a line outfit. Oh, okay. So they sent me to Fort Jackson, South Carolina, the 87th Infantry Division. Now, maneuvers in Tennessee, jungle training in Florida. When the hell are we going to get into this fight? One day they took us out to a big field, and they said that there's going to be a demonstration today. We said, what kind of demonstration? Shut up and sit down. We sit down. 3 C-47s come up out of the sky. We see the doors open. We see guys throw themselves out of the door and the little white thing takes them down to the ground. You know, paratroopers were brand new in World War II. And guys come double-timing up the field. They line up in front of us, shiny silver wings, jump boots, shiny. You know, only paratroopers were allowed the blouse, your pants, and the boots, you know, very macho. And the captain comes by and says, "This is the United States Parachute Corps. We're looking for a few good men. You have to have had your 19 weeks, your 4 weeks, and your 2 weeks advanced infantry training. And who wants to volunteer?" "Hey, but wait a minute. Throw yourself out of an airplane?" And he says, "And there's $50 extra on jump pay." That did it. That did it. Now, back at Fort Benning, the jump school, you're already a trained infantry soldier. Now, what they have to teach you is how to jump out of an airplane. And again, it was marvelous. We had the best sergeant trainers in Europe. We had the best officers they'd taken. All morning was physical training. Mm. They made you tough. Then in the infantry, you walk 30 mile heights, in the paratroops, 50 mile heights. In the infantry, you walk every place. In the paratroops, you run every place. You double time, you're not allowed to stand still with that. We loved it. The confidence they gave us made us feel we could take the whole of that German army on by ourselves when we got over there. We were really well trained, and because we were seeking it and relishing it, we did even better than they expect. I can't believe the lessons they taught us and how when combat time came made a difference. Mm. The one example would be physical training, arms extended, wind them up. And so you wind them up. And you're waiting for him to say stop, but he doesn't say stop. We keep winding. We keep winding. And finally, they get those arms up. And then you positive. Get those arms up. Finally, he says stop. "No, I didn't tell you to put your arms down. Get them up again." You get them up again. You wound them up. Now unwind them. You know what you find? They're training your brain.
Mm, yes, sir.
You feel you can't do any more. They said to you, "No, you can do more." And you did. You were positive before. You couldn't. You did. You did. Get them out. They're running up and down. Keep them up. Keep them up. Keep them up. And in combat, you know what kind of difference that made? When you're under a sustained artillery attack, I can't take it. "The hell you can't take anymore. You remember back then training when you said you can't do anymore? No, you damn well you can do some more. You can push that body of yours until the brain tells it to stop, not you and your muscles." Mm. It was fantastic.
Extraordinary.
Well, we finally graduated from the jump school. I won't go through the jumps, the first jump. You had to make 5 jumps. Well, I'll tell you a little bit about it. You had to make 4-day jumps and 1-night jump. And then the next Saturday morning, you know, graduate, wings and all. Huh. Now, on the jump training, the last week of our 5-week training, they included parachute packing. And we said, "Why the hell do we have to learn how to pack the parachute?" They said, "Because the first jump you make is going to be a jump on a chute that you packed." You never saw a more attentive class in your whole life. We watched and we came in. So, and the bad thing was it that Friday is when you finish packing your chute, but the jump is not till Monday. And here you're all that weekend. "Oh, did I do it?"
Wow.
Sergeant, "No, whatever you did, you did." Of course, we were supervised when we did it. And that first day, besides everything else you're worried about is, did I pack that damn parachute right? But it was, again, good experience. You know, it teaches you, hey, you know, the time comes and then come back. You got to rely on yourself.
Yeah.
By the way, I didn't smoke. I was an innocent, good Catholic boy. I went to church. And so on. I didn't smoke or drink or know anything about girls. And the first jump, we get on a plane and the sergeant said, "All right, the smoking lamp is lit." And everybody takes out a cigarette and they light it. And it like it seemed to help them something. They go, "So I say, give me one of those." So I took a cigarette. I lit it up. and I coughed and spit because I couldn't see. My eyes are blind. Stand up, hook up, stand in the door. Well, no matter what the story is, I got to go out that door.
Yeah,
and I was number three man in the position. Well, you make your first jump. You can't believe it. You can't believe it. It's the most thrilling thing in the world. And you rely on your training and your equipment, and you have no qualms. At least I didn't. Going out that door, throwing yourself out the door with a parachute hanging. What? The static line, cord breaks, the prop blast fills up your parachute, and you slide under it. And then the most peaceful, wonderful sphere in the world. You know, you're told, check your canopy. You look up, beautiful blue sky. You look down, the ground is there. And don't try to maneuver your chute. The old chutes there, if you try to maneuver them, it spills the air out of them and you come tumbling down. But I checked my chute, looked down. Holy crap, the ground's coming up pretty fast. You know, they jumped you at 900 feet then, 800, 900 feet. Because in combat, you know, they don't want you hanging down. A regular parachute jump at 1,200 feet, you got like a minute and a half. Not in a combat jump, open, down. And the ground coming now. All your training's got to kick in, right? You face the wind, put your feet and your knees together. When your toes hit the ground, collapse to your right-hand side, roll, grab your parachute, pull the spill the air out of it. And and that my first jump, I pulled the chute in, and I lay on the ground, and I just said, man, I didn't crap in my pants or piss on my boots. I'm a paratrooper. And I said, no way. You got four more to go. But, Josh, I had all beautiful jumps. You know, if you pay attention to the teacher, the instructor, no trouble.
Yes, sir.
The last one is a night jump. That's the scary one because when you're coming down, looking down at the ground, you know, bushes look like trees. You can't read the depth perception at night and so on. But I made that one, too, with no trouble and so on. The next morning, we giving our wings and told your paratroopers, now you're going into combat. Now you're going into combat. And I couldn't believe it. It was November, and we knew that there was still enough war there for us to get into. And, you know, in the midst of all kinds of danger and murder, there's always some little funny things that happen. While we were in Fort Benning there, every once in a while the Army would give us what they called spaghetti. And, you know, we Italian-Americans, and I used to bitch at thinking, yeah, you call this stuff spaghetti? What a bunch of crap. If we ever get anywhere near New York, I'm going to take you guys to my mother's house for some real spaghetti. I'll let you taste what it really like. So where do we end up before going overseas? Camp Upton, an hour and 45 minutes from my mother's house. So when we get there, guys, all right, spring. What about all that crap you're going to say is let us take you home to taste some real spaghetti. I said, okay. You know, I had to make good now. I called my mother and I said, Mom, I said, you know, I'm going to have a day pass to come home. And I go, oh, I'll make you a nice dinner. I said, Mom, listen, when I was with the boys, you know, the Army, they used to give us what they called spaghetti. It was terrible. And I used to tell the guys, if we're ever near New York, I'd bring them home to let them taste your real spaghetti. And she said, sure, bring them. How many? I said, 18. You know, my stick, one stick. She said, 18. How much time have I got? I said, oh, well, we'll be there for 4 or 5 hours. Oh, and my four sisters, you know, they're all listening, yeah, bring over guys. And as a consequence, about 3.5 hours later, everybody in the neighborhood looking at what the hell, three cars pull up. 18 guys pull out of the car, all paratroopers, into my mother's, you know, very modest house. But they had the setup. She had tables going from the kitchen into the living room, into the dining room and so on, planks between two chairs for seats. But she had the seating for 20 people.
Mm.
And the guys piled in and sat down. And my mother took me aside. She said, listen, I said, you know, when we have spaghetti, we always have wine. And I said, so? She said, but you're all underage. You're 18. The drinking age is 21. I said, hey, we're going to fight for the country. If we could go fight at 18, we could drink wine at 18 years. And, you know, as a consequence, there was a pitcher of wine at every table. And as a consequence, there were some guys feeling pretty good by the end of the meal there. And we're all talking, laughing, so on. And so we put on a demonstration jump out my mother's window. The neighborhood's going nuts watching these guys jump out the window, howling, Geronimo, run around, come back in the house. And then, you know, we had something to talk about. And by the way, there's some postscripts on this story, which I'll tell you about later.
Certainly.
We were on the Queen Mary, which was a troop ship then, and I could write another whole chapter in the book about Queen Mary experience. But we got to England. The Queen Mary can only dock at Southampton, and the Germans had control of the channel then, so instead they took us up outside of Scotland and by small boat put us ashore and took us around to a place called Hungerford. And we were there a few days, and then they flew us to, it was now November, the end of November, to Camp Mormelon in northern France, where the 101st Airborne Division had just come down. I was assigned to H Company, 501 Regiment, 3rd Battalion, and 101st Airborne Division. You need to know a little bit about what the situation is in the background.
Yeah.
101st Airborne Division had just taken a beating in Holland. You heard about the Market Garden operation. The books don't say it, but it was a terrible failure. The 1st Allied Airborne Army jumped in. They took the bridges. The British armor did not come up to back up the paratroopers. The Germans counterattacked. They beat the hell out of the 82nd. They cut off the roads so that the British army couldn't come up. You know, what a stupid plan to begin with, Montgomery and his boys. So the 101st Airborne Division now, when I joined, was supposed to get 90 days of rest, rehabilitation, equipment, winter clothes. Resupplied, you know, had to leave a lot of their equipment, ammunition, and so on and so on. And the war was winding down, you know, winter time, there was always. So nobody knew, neither British intelligence nor American intelligence, that the Germans had quietly built up 25 divisions. 9 of those divisions were panzers with over 1,000 of their newest tanks, the King Tiger, the Tiger Royal, and the Mark IVs. Their plan was, you know, the map, Germany, Belgium. From Germany, from the east, they were going to funnel through the Ardennes and capture Antwerp. Antwerp was our port of entry. So all our supplies, gasoline, equipment, so on and so on, would have been denied us, and they would have had them. It would also have separated the British and Canadian armies in the north from the American armies in the south. Maybe change the war.
Right.
Their plan was to negotiate a peace with the West and then turn their full attention to the Russians. At any rate, to get to Antwerp through Belgium, they had to go through this little town called Bastogne, little village, 4,000 or 5,000 people. But it was a transportation hub. It had 5 roads in the end, and it had 2 railroads going through. And there were only 4 American divisions holding the Ardennes line. 4th, 28th, 128th, 9th Army. December the 16th, nobody had an inkling. By the way, our division commander was in America making speeches. Our deputy division commander was in England making speeches. The only general on the base was McAuliffe, who was the artillery commander. 25 divisions hit those 4 American divisions in there and destroyed them completely. By the way, an incident, I had to back up a little bit. I told you that they hadn't sent us any winter clothes yet or any extra food, ammunition, so on and so on. And so when they hit the 4 American division there, they just destroyed them. The stragglers were ordered to go back through Bastogne. Now, the situation I was referring to before was that when they told us we're going up, we said, you're crazy. The ground's frozen. We'll all break our legs. They said, you're not going up. You're not going to jump. You're going up in trucks. All I could think of was all my airborne training. I'm going to make my first jump off the back of a truck. But that's another thing. You know, the details are in the book. But that night, no stops, packed into these open trucks like sardines. But we got from Camp Mormelon, 130 miles away, to Bastogne all day and all night ride. They later said it was the most miraculous movement of a whole division. So when we got there, the lieutenant said, all right, 5 yards apart and watch out for snipers. We said, what the hell? Those of us that were unarmed. Later on, they told us the figure was 10% of us.
Wow.
I was a machine gunner without a machine gun. I had a trench knife. And I had no helmet, no rifle. Some of them didn't. None of us had winter clothes. And what saved us was the guys that were stragglers had a report to go through Bethlehem to go back. We were just one of them. They said, hey, listen, you're going back. You know, the rifle right off his shoulder. You got any grenades? Went in his pockets, took grenades. I found a guy with a nice light machine gun. I said, ooh, that looks so heavy for you, pal. Let me help you carry it. And I took his gun and it had two belts of ammunition. By the way, these guys were in a day. They anything we wanted to do, they gave us everything. So at least for the first fight, all of us were armed. We had something. Besides the machine gun, I took an M1. I would load it down with everything, but you know damn well, two belts of ammunition, the first 5 minutes of a fight, that's going to be gone. So I took a little, and I'm on the bandolier. I looked like a mule when I was walking through the thing. But take us out. We got there one day before the Germans hit. Just enough time to set up. And our officers, we had the best damn officers in the world. Our officers, my regimental commander was Colonel Ewell. And he was soft-spoken, but tough, and, you know, he took care of his men. But, you know, you obey orders, man, or you're in trouble. At any rate, the 501, my regiment, of the three regiments in the 101st, were the first ones to get out of town to meet the German. And Colonel Ewell only had his first battalion out of his three battalions. The other two were still trying to get out of town. He was told to go out and develop the situation. You know, nobody knew what was there. Nobody knew what was coming. All they said is they're out there in force. Well, Colonel Ewell and the 501 is dug in right where the Germans are coming in from, the Longville Road from Germany through Belgium. Well, Colonel Ewell runs into the lead elements of 25 divisions, and instead of cutting and running, he attacks. He called back 2nd and 3rd Division, get your asses out here, mega fat. He attacks. Now the Germans are surprised. They don't know what the hell's going on. All of a sudden, they get stopped by a battalion of pretty determined guys. So they stop. Enough time for us to get the rest of the 2nd and 3rd Battalion out there, some of the rest of the troops out, stop them cold. When we got off the trucks, and after we had armed ourselves, those of us that were unarmed, and were taken out their head, dig a hole in the ground there. Now, the ground's frozen. He had had no food or water since we got off the trucks. And you hit the ground, it bounces back in your face. You whack it with the shell. Luckily, we had the new shell. Bang, 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 bang. Finally, you get through. It was like 3 o'clock in the morning before we finally got a hole dug. And 2 o'clock in the morning. And my buddy and I, you know, machine gun, this two-man foxhole. We dropped in a hole. Hey, we're moving out. Oh, God, you got to go dig in over there. You curse, you pick up your stuff, you start walking over there, and you're now, you know, you're half dead. Even if you're young and strong, there's only so much. We got a half-baked hole. Hey, we're moving out. Oh, no. The last place we just scraped the snow on the side, lay on the ground. We were spent. We couldn't do it anymore. Woke up a little while later and attempted digging a hole. That morning, this is December 18th. The 17th is when we went up. The fog was all the way down to the ground. You couldn't see. You saw maybe 15, 20 feet in front of you. We're all in our holes, huh? And the fog starts to lift like a curtain, like the whole thing comes up at once. Fog is lift, and we look through, and where I was dug in. And don't forget, your view of the war depends upon where you're located during the battle. I'm in a forward foxhole. I see certain. The guy back here sees less or more. The ones with it, they don't see anything. So you could be talk to two guys that were in the same battle. They tell you two different stories. They're not lying. It depends upon where they were. That first day, the 502 didn't fire a weapon. And the rest of it, because they were not opposed yet. But that's an aside. When the fog lifted high enough to see through, just the whole world exploded. It just exploded. You saw it. This is surely what hell must be like. Every place, the nice, white, pristine snow starts turning black with shell holes. Later, they told us a shell was landing every 8 seconds. Everything, the big gun, the 220, the 120 millimeters, they had mortars. The machine guns were too far away yet. And all we could do is, and the sergeants yelled, keep your heads down, keep your heads down, get down in the hole. They didn't have to give us much encouragement. And all you did was stick your nose down in the bottom of the foxhole, curse yourself for not digging it deeper, and try to plug your ears because the noise is like something you never heard in your life. When the hell are they going to stop? Artillery all over the place. Finally, it stops. And then you hear the grind of the wheels and the treads and the tanks come out of the woods. And where I was, four in a line like this, coming up the thing. And the German infantry starts up back in the woods, coming up toward us. Yeah, even a machine gun can't do anything to a tank, especially the new Tiger Royal. They could take a 75-millimeter hit. And the sergeants are yelling, let the tanks go by! As if we could do anything about it. Bury yourself in a hole and just hope that the tank's not coming over you. One did, but it straddled me so that... And by the way, that's another thing about paying attention. When you dig a hole, you got to dig it right so that it doesn't collapse if something's on the other side, especially good frozen ground, you know. And you dig it right, the tank will go right over you. The stink of it, the noise of it. You know, to this day, I can bring it all back. The tanks go by, and the infantry coming up now, so the artillery now is rolling past us. Got a big surprise. They came up, and they thought, as usual, the tanks soften up. They were firing point blank into the foxhole. When they hit one, the guy disappears. The rifle goes floating up in the air. So it's surreal, you know, when you think back to it. It's like you were in some kind of dream, crazy. You wow. See a guy's rifle go floating down, and he's disappeared. At any rate, the German infantry coming up expected to just roll up like they did the other four divisions. They didn't know the 101st Airborne Division was here. And we let them have it. I mean, they're not, you know, the second and third wave comes up. Now you got lots of them in there trying to get back. It's not nice to say, but it was machine gunner's delight. Man. And, you know, when you're a replacement in an experienced officer, you are nothing until you prove yourself in combat. Nobody even talks to you. They figure it's up there. They don't want to know anything. Once you prove yourself in combat, hey, you can't believe how you're one of the brothers now. But they said, by the way, I proved myself in combat. I got the nickname Curse and Traverse Speranza. They said, what a job I did with my machine gun. They said, but you were cursing. We never heard so much cursing the whole life. We think you invented some new ones. Of course, I wasn't aware of it. I was screaming. But you said, the curse was just right. Oh, 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 oh. And you mowed them down back and forth. The snow turned red. Well, they got beat back. Their first attack failed. Now, when the infantry knows, when the tanks know that the infantry's not behind them, they got to turn around and go back. On their way back, McAuliffe's artillery slaughtered them. All four of the tanks in front of me were hit. All four. You see, what McAuliffe had done, and that's why now I say, thank God the artillery commander was the one who was there during that fight. He had set up his guns so that they could fire not only at the perimeter, but on high enough guns so that he could fire across town to the other side. No matter where the attack comes from, all the guns, and that's the only thing that saved us. Mm. You know, we had one battalion of the 10th Armored Division with 73 tanks.
Wow.
The Germans had over 1,000. We had one battalion of the 705 tank destroyer, but only a handful of vehicles and so on. Those boys were good, by the way. They should be mentioned in the Battle of the Bulge. One battalion of the 10th Armored and one battalion of the 705 tank destroyer. At any rate, their first attack failed. The next day, what they did is they surrounded us. They slipped around on both sides and surrounded us, capturing the field hospital. All the beds, blankets, morphine equipment, everything, doctors. They shot all the American personnel except the doctors. They kept five of our doctors to serve in their army. One doctor and one Belgian nurse escaped into the town with us. And that was our medical team for the whole 8 days of that battle. One doctor, one nurse, and only his own equipment, only his own instruments. He had operated with the candle lights from the church. And you know, the movies always show you the nice cots, nurses. The only buildings in the town that were still standing was the church and the seminary across the street from the church. And they had stone walls. The rest of the town was flat. They had flattened it, mostly wooden buildings, down to the ground. The only place we could put the wounded was somewhere on the floor of the church. And they sent us through the houses to pull blankets, bedspreads, anything we could find in the houses to cover the wounded, because the Germans had all the blankets and all the things. And those of us that had two blankets donated one to the wounded. And we felt so bad. You know, a guy gets wounded and badly expects to go back to a nice hospital, be cleaned, thrown on the floor of the church, and maybe the doctor will get to look at him. It was a bad scene. We lost a lot of people who should have been saved had we had the equipment or the doctors to take care of them. And we lost almost as many men to frozen feet. The temperature, when we got there, it was zero. We had no clothes, no winter clothes. We had these little jackets. And I curse it to this day. They took away our jump boots before we left, and they gave us combat boots. Supposedly, you know, the combat boot only laces up part way, and then there's a leather flap that comes over with buckle that's supposed to be easy to put on things. But the leather on those was turned inside out. That meant that once they got wet, you know, jump boots are waterproof. Even if you put a little bacon grease or something on them, they keep your feet dry. Mm. These things, once they got wet, they stayed wet. We lost as many men, this is a statistic they gave, as many men to trench foot and frozen feet as we did bullets.
Wow.
In the first battle. No, but that's the way it was, you know. That's what happened. That's why this fight was so terrific. And then there are 12,000 of us in that town, 9,000 paratroopers and 1,500 each of the other two outfits, and 56,000 Germans around us attacking. They had all their heavy equipment. They had heavy guns. We swear at one time they had railroad guns, but it wasn't true. It was just some other big guns that they had. And the Luftwaffe came in and bombed everything flat twice and so on. And by the way, we're saying, where the hell is our Air Force? We got the biggest Air Force, the best pilots. Where the hell are they? Mm. The Germans are flying. What we found out later was the weather in England was impossible. They couldn't get off the ground. They're all ready to supply us and so on. They couldn't get off the ground. And so the first day went badly for us. We held them off, but we lost people. And the second day, my friend Joe Willis got hit in both legs. They took him back to the church, threw him on the floor of the church. And my sergeant sent me back to get the batteries for the radio. So and so, while I'm waiting for them to find the batteries, I went to look for my friend. It was a pitiful sight, but I didn't want to make it look like it. Hey! Guys laying all over the floor, some of them still bleeding, some of them with pieces. Some of them got a half of a sleeping bag, some got curtains wrapped around their neck. It was a bad scene, but I wasn't going to add to it. So I just, hey, Joe, smiling. Hey, how's everything going? And he said, nothing. I just got a couple of piece strap in the leg. I'll be out of here tomorrow. I said, you'll be out of here tomorrow? Yeah, tomorrow, the next day or something. It's not bad. Hey, listen, don't worry about me. I'll be back there. I said, well, that's great, Joe. I said, listen, I got to go. Anything I can do for you before I leave? He says, yeah, go find me something to drink. I said, where the hell am I going to find you something to drink? We're surrounded and cut off, and then there's no supplies coming in here. He says, go look in the tavern. It's a bonded shit. Go look anyway. You might get lucky. Hey, you and your foxhole buddy want something to drink? You go find him something to drink. So you got to get the picture. It's snowing. Not the hard kind that hold your face. The artillery is dropping in all around the church, and I'm slopping down the road looking for a tavern. Like, I went to the tavern. The first tavern I went into, it's all broken glass. The second tavern I went into still had a bar, and when I pulled the beer handle, beer came out. That's a good. I look around now for a bottle, but something to put the beer in. There was nothing. The same helmet you use in the foxhole, you know. Yeah. I swished a little snow in it. I filled it up with beer and went back to it. Now, don't forget, I'm a 19-year-old stupid kid. I go back to the, hey, Joe, I got some beer. And he said, whoa. So he sits up and I'm feeding him beer from the helmet. Hey, give me some of that. Hey, give me some of that. Hey, give me some of that. I was like an old mother cow. They're giving everybody a mouthful of beer. I ran out. Joe says, go get some more. Go get some more. I go down the road, fill up the beer, the helmet again. This time when I stepped out the door, a shell landed me, but it knocked me down. I spilled most of the beer and so on. But I didn't get hurt. I got up. But this time when I got back to the church, standing in the doorway like this, is the regimental surgeon, Major Walkman. I'm a PSC. He says, what the hell do you think you're doing, soldier? And sir, they're bringing aid and comfort to the wounded. He said, you stupid jackass. Don't you know I got chest cases and stomach cases, and if you give them beer, you'll kill them? Get out of here if I have you shut. Get out. And put that helmet on. But I ran like hell back to the foxhole before he changed his mind. I could write another book about what happened the next 4 hours. The guys trying to keep me from freezing solid. Took my clothes over, wrinkled, everybody wrapped around me. But I survived it, naturally. And it was an incident that happened to me. I forget about it. There was a million incidents that happened to me during the war. I forgot all about it. 65 years later, when I went back for the first time to visit Bastogne. Well, first of all, let me say this. When I came home, I was 20 years old, and I said to myself, listen, you remember in the neighborhood you used to see these guys that came back from World War I, show shock, nightmares, beat up their kids and so on. You're not going to be one of those. Understand? You're going to take all this stuff, cutting people in half with a machine gun, and put it back in. You're going to lock the door. You're going to lock the door, and you can't forget it, but you can isolate it, and maybe over time you will be able to. You're a school teacher now. You're building, not destroying. And so for 65 years, I didn't join the American Legion. I didn't know anything about the celebration. Nothing. I was an educator. One day in a shop, I meet a woman with an accent. I said, Madame, do I denote a French accent? She said, no, Belgique. I said, oh, Belgium. She said, yes, do you know Belgium? And I said, well, yeah. Bombs, bullets, and snow. That's what I know about Belgium. And she said, oh, you were there during the war. I said, yes. She said, with the 101st Airborne Division. I said, yes. She said, you have not been back. I said, no, I don't. He said, monsieur, you must go back. The people of Bastogne have never forgotten the 101st Airborne Division. There are monuments to you all over town. There are dinners and celebrations. Every year, December 16th, they put on men and women, all the men and women in town put on American uniforms with the Screaming Eagle patch. They reenact the battle. They have dinners and you must go back. There are so few of you left. They want to honor you. They want to find out. And I said, but my daughter was with me. She heard it. And she said, Pop, if nothing else, maybe we ought to go back to the cemetery anyway and pay our respects to where your guys are buried. I said, well, yeah, you know, that pinched my conscience a little bit. And I said, yeah, okay. Now, that decision changed my whole life. I was 85 years old man, sitting around waiting to die. They had taken my wife away and so on. And that decision to go and, again, a whole bunch of accidental meetings, quote, like that, changed my life from an old man sitting around waiting to die to I'm a playboy today, running around. Oh, but at any rate, we go to Bastogne. The plan was just to stay 3 days, and I was going to take her to Paris. She'd never been, and then home, and that was the end of it. And I'd be dead by now, because once you slow down, no, because of another accidental meeting decision, We're on the way to the bank to change our money to euros. And my daughter sees in the window of the shop a mannequin with a 101st Airborne Division paratrooper Screaming Eagle patch. And she says, "Pop, look." I said, "Yeah, we're going to the bank." "Well, let's go." Now, if I had insisted, that would have been the end of it. We just stayed 3 days and got on. No, because I said, "Okay, let's go look." In there, we meet a big Dutch paratroop officer. We found out that later. We didn't know what it was. As we're going out, we looked around. And on the way out, he sees us and he says, "And he got, you know, perfect English. Anything I can do for you, sir?" His name was Marco Killing. I said, "Nah, I'm just looking around. I was here doing the war." He said, "You were here doing the war?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "With the 101st Day One Division?" I said, "Yeah." He come around the counter. I thought he was going to attack me. I went to a defense one. He picked me up. "Sir, where have you been? We are looking for we want to honor you. Who were you with?" I said, "H Company, 501. He said, "Do you know that I can take you out and show you where H Company was dug in?" I said, "Really?" "Yeah," he said, "you know that we studied the war. We teach it to our kids. It's in the schools because the Americans saved." He said, "You and your daughter get in the car." And a friend of his, Johnny Boner, who was a Belgian tank commander, comes in the car and he drives us out of town. Now, I recognize nothing. During the war, it was all covered with snow and this and the growth. I didn't recognize a thing. But he takes me out there for a while and was familiar with the signpost, with Mont, but takes us out and he says, "Look, H Company was dug in here, 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 and on the ridge." Then he looks me in the eye like this and says, "And that was your foxhole." I said, "Get out of here. Get away from me." I can understand you knowing where H Company was dug in. "How the hell do you know that was my foxhole?" He said, "Because your company commander, Captain Stanley, when he turned in his after action report, on the back of a piece of cardboard from a K ration, he had a rough diagram of where he had put the automatic weapons. You were the only machine gun in the 3rd platoon, right?" "Yeah, look, 3rd platoon, MGU.
Wow.
Now you got a picture. You're 85 years old, and somebody is saying to you, where you're standing right now, 72 years ago, you were a 19-year-old kid with a machine gun waiting for the first German attack. Josh, all the things that I had put back here came back and hit me right in the face. I even heard the artillery again, explosions, the guy's body is all over. You're 85, you don't have the control anymore. I fell apart. My daughter pulls me aside and says, Marco, listen, my father's seen enough. Let's go back. We'll come back tomorrow." So Marco says, "Yeah, I understand, of course." So on the way back, I asked her if I could take them to lunch. I take them to lunch. My hotel, you know, the fancy dining room. At lunch, I ordered 3 bottles of wine. I said, "I don't like the mood we're in here. I got to start feeling different." And so on. Consequently, you put 3 old soldiers and 3 bottles of wine together. did my daughter get embarrassed? They start talking loud and they start telling stories. Johnny Boner tells stories about Belgian tanks, and Marco tells story about fighting in Bosnia and Afghanistan. And when it came my turn, I told them the beer story that I just told you. While I'm telling the story, they're going, You were the GI who brought beer? And I said, "Yeah." "You, the guys are laying on the floor of the church and you gave them the beer, the wounded?" I said, "Yeah." They said, "Man, don't you know you're famous in Europe?" Said, "What the hell are you talking about?" They said, "Waiter, come here. Bring us 4 bottles of airborne beer." And the waiter comes back with a tray, and he's got 4 bottles of beer and 4 little ceramic bowls in the shape of a GI helmet.
Huh.
They serve it in.
Wow.
Wait a minute. I'll show it.
Yeah.
This is the helmet. Can you see it?
Can you raise it up just a little bit, sir? There you go. Perfect. Huh.
That's a helmet.
Yeah.
Here's the bottle of beer. The label on it shows a paratrooper with a helmet full of beer. Can you see it?
Huh.
A paratrooper with a helmet full of beer going like this. They said, nobody thought that was a true story. They said that. we can't believe it. It's a true story. And the guy who did it is standing right here in front of us now. I said, yeah, maybe I should get a cut on the beer, right? They didn't let them. No. But they gave me 6 bottles of beer to take home. Now, when I got home, the newspaper, my local newspaper here, no, the state wide newspaper, the big newspaper in Illinois, said, hey, we heard a story about you. Could we come to the house and interview you? And I said, yes. And they came to the house. But the reporter got the story. And the photographer took a picture of me. And on your cell phone, you have to Google airborne beer, and you'll see the picture I'm talking about. And they put it on the front page of the newspaper the next day. Somebody took it from the newspaper and put it on the internet. And I became more famous for what I did with a helmet full of beer than what I did with my machine gun the whole war. Now, Josh, I got 2 brown stars, 2 purple hearts, the French Legion of Honor, the Belt. I got 15 million medals. One of them, hey, Vince, tell us the beer story. They called it the greatest beer run in history. And I, you know,
extraordinary.
I resented. I'm a combat soldier. But they want to know about how I brought beer to my buddies in the hospital, in the field. At any rate, Josh, getting back to the war.
Yes, sir.
The second day, we were holding our own. Third day now, that's the 22nd, it looks bad. The artillery's down to 2 shells per gun. The sergeants have to go around every night and redistribute ammunition. You got 2 bullets, give him 1, and so on and so on. And the weather had dropped to 12 below. One night they said it was 18 below zero.
Wow.
The bolt wouldn't open on the rifles. And it looked bad on the 23rd. The 23rd, the sun came out. We couldn't believe it. You see, the sun came out, and that morning, 6 P-47 Thunderbolts. That was their newest, America's newest fighter bomber. 6 planes come out of the sky, dropped down, and sort of bombed and strafed all around us, silenced the German artillery, and then 130-something C-47s came in and dropped supplies. Food, gasoline. It's the important thing, artillery ammunition. But also dropped a glider in with a couple of more doctors and medical supplies, because the doctor was operating without morphine. Now we, the frontline infantrymen, I say, overcoats, clothes, hats, nothing, not 1 plane load of clothes. When they came in, we blessed them. When they left, we cursed them. You're stupid. I said, don't you know that the frontline guys... You got to have both hands to fire your weapon. That figure won't work. And no clothes. But the artillery ammunition meant that no matter what they tried, they weren't going anywhere. Next day, we see a Jeep, 2 German officers in front, 1 drive with a white flag. Cocky bastards that we were. We thought they wanted to surrender. We said, hey, you had enough, eh?
Wonderful.
But of course, later on, we heard the story. They came in and they asked to see McAuliffe. And they said, the tides of war have changed. Now, we know you're low on supplies, food, and ammunition. We have captured all the little towns around you here, so there's no escape. There's no way for you. We offer you honorable surrender terms. We'll give you 2 hours to consider it. If the answer is no, we have 3 Army Corps ready to reduce Bastogne to complete rubble and slaughter everybody in town. This is not in accordance with America's well-known humanity for civilian populations. Now, later on in the newspaper, McAuliffe's supposed answer was nuts. And the German commander said, nuts? Was ist das nuts? Positive or negative? And Colonel Hayward said, definitely negative. It means get the hell out of here. When we heard the story, we said, McAuliffe said, nuts? You know, because of some of the big, he probably told them to go, they can't print that. So they said, well, nuts. Okay.
Nuts it was.
All right. Well, the next day was Christmas Day, the 25th. They poured on the last attempt. They shelled us all day. The tanks were firing out of the woods and everything. Didn't make any difference. These were the American 101st Airborne Division Parachute Corps. And on the 26th, Patton broke through. But, you know, Patton didn't do any fighting there, so a lot of people at Patton, but he was busy on the other side of the France. What he did was get our wounded out, get them to the hospital, and then he left. And that's all we wanted. We had been resupplied now. We were ready to go on defensive. Wow. How's my time doing? I got a quit from me. At any rate, third day, after the 26th, the 27th, 28th, now we break out of Bastogne, the town, and start taking a battle to them. The Germans had shot their wad. Now they're going back. They leave the SS behind for rear guard action. Those guys didn't quit till the end of the war. But they start back, and we're now chasing them and going through the woods and so on and so on. The Beaujac woods twice, I was in there. But the second time for that battle for that wood, that was just north of Bastogne, I got hit. January 5th, I got hit. And it was like tree bursts, so that a lot of it was just superficial. One piece went under my eye. They thought it was touching the brain, so they flew me to a British hospital. And at the hospital, it wasn't touching the brain, no problem. They just pulled it out. And, man, I was just living in heaven. Beds with sheets. Nice nurses fooling around. We used to pinch them on the ass. And we just had a wonderful ball and saying, can't this last a little longer? But, you know, the fifth day, you're going back. And at the time, I was fooling around with our nurse, and she said, there's another one of you naughty paratroopers on the second floor. I said, really? Who? I said, Joe. I said, not Joe Willis. He said, yeah, that's what I think his name is. Willis from Florida. That's my buddy. Can I go see him? She said, no. As soon as she went down the hall, I went down to see him. He said, hey, right after you got hit, I got hit. I said, no kidding. He said, yeah. He said, but, hey, listen, you know what I heard? When we get discharged from here, we get 5 days of recuperation leave and 1 day traveling each way for the next week before we go back to the war. Man, we're going to do it right and live it up. When do you get out? I said, tomorrow. No, I don't get out till Thursday. Go tell them you're still sick. I went back. I said, oh, you know, my hip is still where that left. She starts laughing like a. She said, don't worry, the doctors will cooperate. We know you want to get out when your buddy gets out, right? And we said, yeah. Well, I can't go into it because it's too long. Mm. But when you read in the book what Joe Willis and I did in Glasgow, Scotland, and how I got started on Scotch whiskey, where Scotch and Cigar Speranza comes from, I'll describe it this way. Before we left, one of the ladies said, oh, Vincent, Scotland will never be the same without you naughty paratroopers. Well, we got back to the outfit, and the only last thing I want to tell you about is we're now being used as regular ground troops. They put us on trucks, and our job was to keep the push, and the SS was holding it up, and we had to fight them all the way back to it. And when we reached southern Germany, they told us it was just they think there might be some Germans dug in here. We've got to clean out the see if there's any. So we form a skirmish line, 5 yards apart, fixed bayonet, and you walk through the woods. There were no Germans. The foxholes were empty. But the further we walk, we noticed a smell. When we walk, now got stronger. And don't forget, we're 18 and 19-year-old kids. We were good, tough combat troops by then. But in terms of life experience and so on,
sure.
What we came across, you could not believe the shock itself. In the clearing, a big 12-foot-high double-wall barbed wire fence all around, compound, two big gates that were open now. I get emotional even talking about it now, 78 years later, but I can't help it.
Yes, sir.
The bones, the ovens were still smoking with bones in them. On the right-hand side, there was a shed with cubby holes. People, one guy in each cubby hole, half of them dead, half of them standing there with their mouths open and eyes. Huh? A big hole dug in the middle of the compound. Thrown like garbage, you know, no dignity of it. Thrown like garbage, a pile of bodies, all sizes, baby, this one, old men, old women, all skin and bones. And the bulldozer was just going to push him in a hole. Nobody is walking. They're crawling on their elbows. You know, the movies show you, well, maybe other places it was like, but they crawl on elbows and hugging our feet, kissing our boots, comrade. And you try to help. No, you can't touch them. They're a bundle of pain. If you try to lift them, no. But some of the guys just took the rifle, shooting up in the air. Some of them just slipped down and started crying. Other guys just keep shaking their head. I don't believe this. I can't. You know, we had heard rumors about concentration camps, but it was supposed to be for criminals. The people when the realization that these people hadn't done anything to anybody only because they were Jews. They didn't revolt against the government. They didn't refuse to serve the German weather officer. Who the hell are you to say these people should not live? These kind of that day, whatever respect I had for the German army, the German people disappeared. And nobody hasn't come back. I'm still in my mind. I'm pointing to a guy who says, "You're not a human being. You're an animal. You have no right. The right for living and dying is up to the guy upstairs. You may not say this one may live this one, and for whatever whim, only because you don't like their religion. What the hell kind of people are you? What kind of people are you? At any rate, the guy that was hugging my feet." So it's saying something like Magyar, Magyar, Magyar. And I understood that to be a Hungarian word. And my friend Steve Pintek is Hungarian. I said, "Steve, come here. What's this guy saying?" By the way, we were trying to give him chocolate. The medical officer said, "No, don't give him anything. They have to be fed a certain way now. And so don't give him any food." The guy hugging my feet and Steve came over and I said, "What's he saying?" He says, "Come on, that little pond out there has fish in it." So we said, "Oh, well, took a hand grenade, a concussion grenade, you know, threw it in the pond." 18-year-old eyes, okay? 19-year-old eyes looking at this stuff. They all go crawling down on the thing there, grabbing the fish and just eating them. Oh. No, even with biting through the spines of it. Unforgettable, unforgettable. They sent us out on patrol to see if any Germans are still around. I'd feel sorry if we ever found one or caught one. They weren't. They'd gone. And the squads of medics and medical teams came to the camp. The only satisfaction we got later when we heard about it, Eisenhower made every man, woman, and child in the nearest town who claimed they never knew what was going on to come in here and over 14 years of age and properly bury all those people. You know, you got a little bit of satisfaction out of that, but that was April. May the 6th, 7th, we got Birch's Garden. That was the first town we didn't have to fight for. The people, before we got there, the people had put out white blankets and sheets and pillowcases and so on, indicating surrender, so we didn't have to fight. The next day, May the 8th, we had heard about the Eagle's Nest. We went up to the Eagle's Nest, and, you know, a bomb had hit the place. And we're all looking at it, getting souvenirs, you know, like I got two nice books from Adolf Hitler. They're in the museum. And we got the word, "Hey, May 8th, the war's over." Well, man, it was celebrated. But the most significant thing that happened to me that day, up on the wall, there was a map, about 3 feet by 5 feet, a map of the world. It was color-coded in three colors, green, red, and brown. Brown was Germany, green was Italy, and red was Japan. The cocky bastards had already decided how they were going to divide up the world. They were positive they were going to win. Germany was to get all of Europe down to the Mediterranean, all of the Ukraine up to the Ural Mountains in Russia. Germany was to get Canada and the United States. Italy was to get Africa and South America. And Japan was to get all of Asia, including Australia. There it was on the wall. Why, if anybody ever doubted why that war had to be fought and why it had to be won, there it was. That was the blueprint for the future. Three dictators were going to run the world, and 95% of us were going to be slave labor.
Wow.
You know, every once in a while you hear these stupids, I don't know, we were fighting England and France at war. We did it. You? Just like the ones who said the Holocaust never happened. Man. And right after that, you know, we got the 101st Airborne was broken up. They put us in the 82nd. They were going to fly us to the Japanese war, but the atomic bomb ended everything. And 4 months later, I got home. I was with the 82nd Airborne then, and we marched in a big ticker tape parade and then discharge.
Brilliant.
And that's the end of my story.
That was excellent, sir. Thank you so much for sharing it. I tell you, I know we've been going for a little while yet. I hate to intrude any more than I already have, Vince. Just to say, it was an honor to speak with you, sir. An honor to hear your stories, and thank you for your service.
Okay. Nice being with you.
Thank you, Vince. You take care, sir.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you'd like to support Eyewitness History, the easiest way to do that would be to subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. For more information on Eyewitness History, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com, where you can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Podcast Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's History of the Papacy, James Early's Key Battles of American History, and Richard Lim's This American President, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art, inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.